From Katanning to Mexico, Phillipsburg to Pittsburgh, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Tom Wolf wants municipalities to start paying for state police protection. Such a move would trigger huge local property tax hikes. David Senko from the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors is here to explain. Chordoma is a rare type of cancer that is difficult to diagnose and to treat. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Josh Sommer of the Chordoma Foundation in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan continue to claim American lives. Do we even know what we're fighting for? Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania takes a closer look on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to David Senko from the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The safety of students in public schools remains a top concern. Despite that, Governor Tom Wolf has proposed cutting funding for the School Safety and Security Grant Program by $45 million, or 75%, next year. The slash in proposed school safety spending was included in a budget Wolf submitted to the General Assembly 2 weeks ago. State Senator Scott Martin of Lancaster County authored the law establishing the grant program. It provides money to school districts to ramp up safety and security measures. Martin said the funding is, quote, too important to be held hostage for other political demands, end quote. More than $1 billion in wagers were placed in Pennsylvania last year in legal sports betting, one of just three such states to pass the billion-dollar betting mark in the first full year since a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that cleared the way for legalized sports gambling. Some $13 billion in sports wagers were placed nationwide in 2019, with $1.5 billion of that laid down in the Keystone State. Nationwide, that generated $118 million in revenue for state and local coffers. State Senator John Gordner of Columbia County has introduced a bill that would move the date of the Pennsylvania presidential primary in 2024 to the third Tuesday in March. Currently, voters in Penns Woods cast their presidential primary ballots the fourth Tuesday in April, which places Pennsylvania deep into the primary calendar. Gordner said having the state vote earlier in the process would, quote, allow our citizens to play a much larger role in determining the outcome of these critical elections, end quote. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Charging municipalities for state police protection has been a goal for Governor Tom Wolf for many years. He has once again proposed forcing cities, boroughs, and townships to pay for state police services. This time, even municipalities which already have their own police force would be required to chip in. The impact on municipal budgets would be significant and would trigger massive hikes in local property taxes. For details, we turn to David Senko. Dave is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors. Dave, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Dave, Governor Wolf, again, with his budget address here a couple of weeks ago, is back on this issue of wanting to charge municipalities, specifically townships, in the case of the organization you represent, specifically townships, but other municipalities, for state police protection. Can you first of all tell us what the governor is proposing to do?
The short and simple answer is he's proposing to use local governments like they're an ATM machine. It's a place you can just go to get extra money to help balance the state budget, and it's unfair to taxpayers all across Pennsylvania. The longer answer is he wants to charge communities. The state has not kept up with appropriately funding the state police, and they're looking to pick up some of the money from the motor license fund to put back on roads, but to fill the gap by charging locals for their using state police. Whether you have a local police department or don't have a local police department.
Wouldn't we look at this state police protection, which is what we're talking about here, as a core function of state government, Dave?
Absolutely. Public safety and state police correspondingly is a core function. I mean, Pennsylvania has proud tradition and one of the oldest state highway patrol state police systems in the country. And they do a great job, but they don't enforce local ordinances. They don't enforce local speed limits. I mean, they do state things. They do state laws. They state fire marshal, state crime lab, all things that everybody pays for every day with their income taxes.
Interesting you mentioned that the state police are partially paid for from the motor license fund. I seem to recall that a number of years ago, many years ago, that was just a line item in the general fund budget. How is it that we came to be paying for state police protection out of a fund that's meant to maintain roads?
In the mid-40s, there was a ballot question creating the motor license fund and a recognition at the time that the state highway patrol did provide a public safety function in keeping the highway safe. So it was a small, modest contribution that everybody agreed was appropriate to come out of a highway budget. I think the challenge has been over the last 20, 25 years, the legislature has seen that pot of money as like a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and it's a place where you can go and just push off other expenses. So it's now up to almost $750 million that is diverted from highway projects into paying for the state police.
As we look around the state, Dave, townships cover everything from very large suburban townships to very sparsely populated rural townships. Which type of township, or is it a mix, that tends to have a municipal police force?
I think the answer to that question is that each community makes their own decision for what's best for them, which is why a one-size-fits-all solution doesn't work. So everybody gets a base layer of state police coverage. Their communities, as they develop more, as they maybe experience more crime or more traffic or more population, that they want more than what the state police can give them, and they will make a decision to invest in either a local police department or a regional police department. But it's when you want service beyond the basic service that the state police provides.
So we do have a number of these municipal or regional police departments all around the state. The governor is now wanting municipalities to pay for state police protection. Is there going to be some sort of a formula for, say, a municipality that has a municipal police force would pay less than one that doesn't? Does the governor have a particular formula in mind for that, or has he not yet added that level of detail?
Well, I think there is a formula. We've asked to see the formula and have been told that as soon as it's corrected, it'll be made available. I think they've taken essentially the costs of operating a state police barracks and overlaid that or divided that dollar figure into the geographic population area that barracks serves, which is why there can be vastly different per capita figures by neighboring communities. They then put some kind of weighting onto it that accounted for the mean population in the municipality, and also then a reduction factor if you had a local police department or did not. So it's a kind of a complicated. I'm guessing it's like some kind of water balloon that you push in one place and it pops out somewhere else. But it seems to be a very complicated formula. It's not just population-based. We got one call from a community that has one of the state system universities in. They have a population of about 1,000 people without the university, but have 5,000 with the university. And those 1,000 people are going to be asked to share the cost of providing state police coverage to the 5,000 because the community is not allowed to tax the students who are on campus. So that instance, you've got a really disproportionate cost falling on residents that, frankly, should be state police anyway.
We are talking with Dave Sanko, who is executive director of the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors. Our topic so far, and we're going to get a little bit into fire protection here in a minute, has been an effort by Governor Tom Wolf to essentially surcharge municipalities around the state for state police protection. Dave, this, of course, is part of the governor's budget proposal. Over the last 5 years, we've seen a lot of proposals for taxing and spending from the governor. Very few of them have fortunately gone anywhere. In terms of the lay of the land in the General Assembly, does this issue have much support for the governor's plan?
I don't think there will be. I think there are a lot of competing priorities. I think at the end of the day, everybody recognizes that, look, it's important to fund highways, and we may have to do that a different way. But the state should be funding its share of the state police rather than pushing that off to any other special interest, but especially not local governments, because at the end of the day, all that's doing is forcing either a local income tax increase or a local property tax increase, and most communities just can't afford either one of those.
We could have a whole conversation about highway funding. We did remind our listeners that about a 30-cent a gallon gasoline tax increase went into effect here a few years ago. Also, a lot of money being diverted from the turnpike. On a future show, we'll discuss all of those issues. But I'd like to pivot a little bit right now, Dave, because another major issue and an even more pressing issue facing townships is fire protection. Do we still find that a lot of townships around the state rely on volunteer fire departments?
Absolutely. There are, 30 years ago, there were 300,000 volunteer firefighters in Pennsylvania. Today, there are less than 50,000. They still have the same amount of territory to cover. It's becoming very challenging and difficult to make that happen. And townships, under state law, have that obligation to provide, make sure there's fire protection provided to their communities. So they're trying to do things with recruiting and retention and shared services to avoid the potential pitfall of having to go to a career paid fire service, because the state fire commissioner estimates that'll cost between $8 and $10 billion, and that's a lot of property tax increases.
In terms of these volunteer firefighters, Dave, does PSAT support any particular measures or efforts that would make it more attractive for an individual to want to become a volunteer firefighter?
Yeah, we participated on the Senate Resolution 6 Commission, which came up with a series of recommendations to try and incentivize volunteer firefighters, from tax credits to tuition assistance programs to one of the big challenges the firefighters have is the hundreds of hours of training that is required and mandated as they do. Look, everybody wants everyone to be safe, but to have this one-size-fits-all training standard across the board, whether you live in a rural community that has a lot of farm fields, or if you live in a building or a community that has tall high-rise fires, the guys who live in the rural areas don't need to know how to fight a high-rise fire, and the guys in the high-rise fires don't need to learn how to draft water out of a creek.
We have again been talking with Dave Sanko, who is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors. Dave, tell us a little bit about what PSATS does and also where folks can find you on the web.
PSATS is a member service organization. We represent the 1,400-plus townships around Pennsylvania and provide them with educational and training opportunities to help share best practices and give them the tools to do their job better, more affordably, and efficiently. And you can find us at www.psats.org.
Dave Sanko from the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors. Dave, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Chordoma is a rare form of cancer which often goes undiagnosed and then is difficult to treat once it is. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation learns more from Josh Summer. Josh is co-founder and executive director of the Chordoma Foundation. Joe?
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Josh, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Joe.
Josh, tell me a little bit about what Chordoma is. You're the co-founder, executive director of the Chordoma Foundation. What is Chordoma?
It's a rare form of cancer that few people have ever heard of. Certainly, when I was diagnosed with it, not something I was familiar with. It's a form of bone cancer that can occur anywhere along the spine, from the head all the way down to the tailbone. And it arises from remnants of an embryonic structure that we all have called the notochord, which plays a really important role during development. And as we develop and after we're born, the notochord essentially is no longer needed and goes away. However, little bits of the notochord end up left inside the bones of the skull and spine. And very rarely, those can turn into a cancer, which is called a chordoma. The problem with chordoma is twofold. First, because of where it's located, it's very, very difficult to treat. Surgeons call the area where chordomas occur, essentially high-value real estate. You don't want to have a tumor next to your brainstem or next to your spinal cord. And then secondly, even when they are effectively treated with surgery or radiation, they tend to come back. And that's really the problem. If the tumors come back, then there's no effective treatment or really a cure for recurrent or advanced tumors.
Is there some kind of a predisposition for this to happen, or is it just kind of like a freak of nature that you just drew a bad number or something?
It's an interesting question. We're learning more about that all the time. The short answer is there is actually a genetic predisposition, but it's interesting in that it's a relatively common predisposition that leads to a rare disease. So about 40% of the population has a genetic alteration or a particular version of a gene that makes them susceptible to chordoma. The other 60% of the population doesn't have it. They don't get chordoma. But within that 40% of the population, your chance of getting it is still very, very low, something like 2 in a million. So not something that people really ought to be concerned about, but it tells us something very interesting about the biology of the disease, which is that this genetic alteration is playing a role in the initiation and the progression of the disease. And that's actually led us to some clues about how to potentially treat the disease.
And how does one diagnose this? I imagine because it's as rare as it is that it may be difficult.
You're exactly right. Add to that, the symptoms are varied and can be relatively common or nondescript. So things like headaches, things like back pain if the tumor is in the back. There are more specific symptoms that are unique to chordoma, things like double vision if the tumor is in the skull base, it can affect the cranial nerves that control eye movement. If it's down in the bottom of the spine, it can present with bowel or bladder dysfunction. So there's a wide range of symptoms, and there is a not insubstantial portion of chordoma patients end up getting either misdiagnosed or have a delayed diagnosis. If you think about it, if you're a doctor, you see one of these symptoms, headache, for example, you're not going to think chordoma. You're going to think the 20 other common things that could cause a headache. Essentially, it's as though, if you hear hoofbeats, you're going to think of a horse. You're not going to think it's a zebra. But in the case of chordoma, it's the zebra.
Does chordoma present itself more for a male or female or for someone in a particular age group?
Yeah, it tends to skew towards people in their middle age. So average age of diagnosis is in the 50s. It's slightly more common in men than women. It is rarer in children, but it does occur in children, even as young as infants. We know a lot more about the disease now. We have gone from this being a poorly understood and poorly studied disease to now being one where there is a very active research community. There's a lot of research being done. And importantly, that research has led us to new opportunities to develop treatments and improve the care of the disease.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Josh Sommer, the co-founder and executive director of the Chordoma Foundation. Josh, tell us a little bit more about your work with the foundation, the kinds of breakthroughs that are occurring, the kinds of networks, the kinds of things that you're doing.
The foundation really sprung from personal experience, first being diagnosed with the disease and dealing with the challenges of finding appropriate care and navigating all the difficulties that came along with treatment, and then becoming motivated to try to improve the odds, to try to see if there's something that could be done to advance research and develop better treatments. And at the outset, there was really nothing being done to advance research or find treatments, and consequently, little reason for hope. And so that led me and a number of other patients and family members back in 2007 to start the foundation, really with two goals. So first and foremost, to improve the lives of individuals affected by the disease, and secondly, to advance the search for a cure. And so over the last dozen years, we've made tremendous strides in both areas. Now, if you are a patient diagnosed with this disease, there is a robust set of resources, educational materials, community that you can plug into. It's no longer a lonely journey, and there is a great deal that is available to help patients get the right care and get the support that they need. At the same time, the research has advanced tremendously. So we've gone from having just a handful of researchers working on this disease in isolation to now having over 350 researchers across the globe and a dozen different drug companies involved. It's led us to an Achilles heel that this disease has, so essentially a vulnerability that if you could strike at it, you could conceivably stop, if not even potentially cure the disease. The really interesting thing is that this vulnerability in chordoma also plays a role in other cancers as well, breast, colon, lung, prostate, et cetera. And so I'd say the most exciting and most timely thing that we're doing right now is working with other organizations to fund drug discovery research around this new target. It's called brachyury, with the idea of developing the first drugs that could go into clinical trials within the next 4 to 5 years. And we're excited about that because we think this could provide the best chance of a potentially curative treatment for chordoma, but also could have an impact far beyond chordoma on other cancers in which brachyury is implicated as well.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Josh Sommer. Josh is the co-founder and executive director of the Chordoma Foundation. Ask all of our listeners and staff here at the Lincoln Institute to pray for what you're doing and keep our fingers crossed for some good outcomes in the near future. Thank you for being a guest on the program.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The war in Afghanistan is now our nation's longest war. Is it time to put an end to it? Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania weighs in on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Americans are not as connected to the military as they once were. And so, in some ways, our wars seem less impactful than they once did. Kobe Bryant's death last month was bigger news than that of Specialist Antonio Moore, an Army reservist. But almost all of us know someone, a family member, a friend, a schoolmate, who serves or has served. So we are all and should feel more connected to the sacrifices our military is called to make, especially the ultimate sacrifice. As the daughter of a retired Air Force pilot and sister of an Air Force Reserve pilot, my reverence for our servicemen and women is personal. Like so many of you, respect for ensuring the safety of our service members and security of our nation are concurrent goals. The United States has been at war since 2001, when we invaded Afghanistan in response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Within a few weeks, the Taliban government, which had supported al-Qaeda, was deposed within Afghanistan, and a decade later, which is now almost a decade ago, Osama bin Laden was shot and killed in Pakistan. Today, no one talks about al-Qaeda as an existential threat to the United States. True, there are still terror organizations that would kill Americans to do harm to our nation. However, they are not to be found currently in Afghanistan. Yet more than 18 years later, we continue to patrol the mountains and valleys of Afghanistan in what is now our nation's longest war. 18 years is the age when young men and women are eligible for enlistment. There are now service members preparing to go and fight in Afghanistan who were not even born on September 11, 2001. Many who have served, and even some who have died there in the last few years, have been too young to have any memory of that day. Nearly 3,000 Americans died on September 11, 2001. Since then, over 6,800 U.S. service members have died overseas in combat. Most of those died after the Taliban and al-Qaeda had been removed from power. Hundreds of thousands more have physical and mental wounds, and most of them have families, tripling or quadrupling the numbers impacted. Here in Pennsylvania, tens of thousands of us have been impacted by these casualties. Similarly, in Iraq, we continue to be engaged in conflict which has lasted almost 17 years, in spite of a declared 2003 victory and the subsequent capture and trial of Saddam Hussein. As with Afghanistan, more Americans died in Iraq after Saddam's overthrow than during. We continue to allow our politicians to spend our most precious treasure, the lives of talented, dedicated, and disciplined Americans, without asking, what are we fighting for? The world is full of risks. It is the proper role of our federal government to secure and defend our nation. But are they doing it well? What is the objective in Afghanistan? Does anyone in government believe that democracy can or will survive there? What are U.S. forces fighting for in Iraq and Syria? It is clear that the issues in this region are deep, pervasive, and intractable. Is propping up corrupt governments in Iraq or Afghanistan worth this many American lives? At Americans for Prosperity, we do not think so, which is why we are invested in a campaign to end endless wars, along with our community partners, Concerned Veterans for America, and the Charles Koch Institute. Recently, the U.S. House passed an amendment voting to repeal the 2002 authorization for use of military force. But that symbolic step must be followed by Senate and executive action. You can join us and scale your voice by going to endendlesswars.com. To find us on Facebook, search at PAAFP, and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director for Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCAT-FM and WHMX-FM in Camp Hill, along with WQXA-FM in York, Pennsylvania. The 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is coming up next month. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of grassroots conservatives every year here in the Keystone State. This year's conference will be held March 27th and 28th at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. Fox News contributor Jason Chaffetz will be the featured dinner speaker. Speakers will include former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, L. Brent Bozell III from the Media Research Center, and Congressman Scott Perry. There will be additional speakers, panel presentations, workshops, and networking. For complete information and to register for the 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, go to paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.